I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you tactical and strategic updates from across the front line, update on diplomatic news from around the world, and we sit down with Spectator journalist Svetlana Moronets to discuss Ukraine's mobilization legislation.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Wednesday, the 17th of April. 2 years and 53 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our associate editor Dominic Nichols, assistant comment editor Francis Sternley, and our guest is Svetlana Moronets. I started by asking Dom for the latest news from Ukraine.
Well, hi David. Hi everybody. Welcome back, Svetlana. A very large Russian attack on the city of Chernihiv this morning. At the time when he was speaking, President Zelensky, he said it had killed 10, injured 20. I'll update that in a moment. Chernihiv is about 100 k's north-northeast of Kyiv. The latest reports I've seen now say 14 dead, 60 wounded. Three Iskander missiles said to have been involved. Explosions heard in the city, right up there in the north, from around 9 a.m. local time today, according to a local media outlet. President Zelensky, speaking some hours ago on Telegram, said, "This would not have happened if Ukraine had received enough air defense equipment and if the world's determination to counter Russian terror was also sufficient. Terrorists can destroy lives only when they first manage to intimidate those who are capable of stopping terror and protecting life. Determination matters. Support matters. Ukrainian determination is enough. There needs to be sufficient commitment from partners and sufficient support to reflect it." Like I say, he was saying that a few hours ago. I think he'll be speaking again probably in the next few hours, but also, I would imagine, in his video address tonight. Now, Alexander Lomako, who's the acting mayor of the city, said that mainly civilian infrastructure had been hit. Chernihiv Oblast is located on Ukraine's northern border with Russia. It was invaded and partially occupied at the start of the full-scale invasion. Russian forces were forced to withdraw in April of that year. But due to its proximity to the border, a bit like Kharkiv, the region has been attacked near constantly, virtually every day up there. Now, elsewhere, there are reports Russian forces struck infrastructure in Odessa Oblast this morning. This comes from Governor Oleh Hipa. He's reported, but without specifying yet, what was hit. I only saw that in the last hour, so no reports yet of what was hit, what the infrastructure has been. No reports of casualties following the attack, him speaking on Telegram. Elsewhere in Ukraine, there's said to be a massive fire at the Zhankoy air base in Russian-occupied Crimea after an alleged Ukrainian strike last night. And then outside the country, Ukrainian drones are said to have attacked a military unit in Russia's city of Kovalkino. That's in Russia's Mordovia region. This is about 300 k's southeast of Moscow, a very, very long way, about at least 500 kilometers from the nearest part of Ukraine. Said to have hit a radar station there. This comes from a source in Ukraine's military intelligence agency, speaking to the Kyiv Independent. Continues this the wave of long-range strikes, as I say, 500 k's from the nearest Ukrainian border. This one on a radar station. Hopefully the US won't object that in an election year it's going to push up the price of radio waves or something, but we will see. Now, next, from reporting from Politico on the significance of Chasiv Yar. We've spoken about it pretty much constantly for the last couple of weeks. If Russian forces capture the besieged town or city, it's thought it will enable them to launch offensives against other cities in Donetsk Oblast. This comes from the Korotsiya Group of Forces spokesperson Nazar Volyshin, speaking to Politico in an article they published yesterday. Russia ramped up its offensive on Chasiv Yar after, trying to bounce on from Avdiivka, trying to maintain the momentum, although it has slightly stalled. It lies about 50 k's to the south of Avdiivka. The tempo of advance declined markedly in March, and there's thought to only be 800 people left in Chasiv Yar, according to local authorities. But Mr. Volyshin went on to explain that the city commands the dominant heights in the region and will and the control of it would allow Russian invaders, as he puts it, to push forward to other cities in Donetsk Oblast. He said if the Russian occupiers manage to capture this city, they will have the opportunity to launch an offensive on Kostyantynivka, Druzhkivka, Kramatorsk and Slovyansk. He said these cities are the last stronghold of Donetsk region, which is under the control of Ukraine. Now, there's been reporting, as we've mentioned the last couple of weeks, it's widely thought that Putin and the Kremlin want to capture Chasiv-Yar or anything, and Chasiv-Yar seems to be the most likely area of any significance. Before May the 9th, the Victory Day parade, as we've seen in recent years, they do like to mark these moments if they can, try and claim some sort of victory. On April the 5th, you may remember, some Russian mill bloggers said that their troops had entered the suburbs, but that suggestion was later refuted by Ukraine's military. And I'll just take a little pause. I've been talking for a little while, David. Take a little pause there for that to settle in.
Thanks, Tom. Before we go to Francis, I know you've been looking at a bit of a tactical deep dive when it comes to Russian soldiering. Can you tell us what you found?
We were talking about Russia's recently adjusted tactics. Adjusted, we think, mainly because of the manpower issue. This is a lot of this reporting, a lot of these ideas based around reporting and geolocated footage from the Institute for the Study of War, the US-based think tank. But we think Russia are just not capable of massing company size, that's about 100 people, let alone battalion size of 400 or 500 people. Those sized attacks, they are much, much smaller, the groups, the forces that are being used, still going for these meat assaults, as they've been known, just up and at them, just running at Ukrainian lines, but still using very poorly trained soldiers, ill-equipped, badly led, and we think still a lot of prisoners in the ranks. Sorry, but Russian forces, particularly in eastern Ukraine, have been observed using smaller groups to conduct assaults. They are reportedly suffering from morale issues. That has been an ongoing factor for, 18 months now-ish since they started getting pushed back by Ukraine. However, ISW say these attacks, as small as they are, or the groupings as small as they are unlikely to culminate in the near term because of the Ukrainian materiel shortages. So culmination, a military term, meaning that the force is basically exhausted. It's not necessarily going to go backwards, be pushed back, but it's no longer got the puff to keep going forward. But because of the ammunition shortage on the Ukraine side, that these attacks, they're not really doing an awful lot, but are unlikely to completely wind down. Now, a spokesperson for the Ukrainian National Guard, Colonel Ruslan Mazichuk, said Russian forces in the east have not recently used large units to conduct assaults, but are using smaller groups, trying to work in two detachments reinforced with armoured vehicles. And that is increasingly becoming a bit of a relative term. The tanks, BTRs, BMPs and all the rest of it are very few and far between now. There's a sort of Frankenstein vehicles of all sorts of stuff down to, we've seen, albeit very limited social media, I'm not saying this is widespread, but we've seen golf buggies and motorbikes. I'll come on to those in a little bit. But the number and the quality of armoured vehicles being used on these ground attacks are very, very limited. Now, Colonel Mazichuk said the Russian forces are using much smaller vehicles without protection to approach Ukrainian positions quickly, sort of race in, see where they are, almost like the thunder runs that the US forces were doing in sort of Baghdad and elsewhere in 2003, racing in to get the enemy to reveal their positions, sort of thing. So we have seen images from social media of Russian soldiers on motorbikes now. There's a time and a place for motorbikes. I'm not denying it. But in the assault, ain't it, I would say, unless they are much better supported. And that, then you're in the kind of in the regions of special ops forces and so on and so forth. So motorbikes in and of themselves will take you directly to the scene of your demise rather than be a basis for a good assault. Now, Mazichuk was saying that Ukrainian drones had destroyed about 70% of Russian armoured vehicles last week, although it was not clear from the text if he was saying the drones had totally destroyed all the vehicles or just damaged them, taking the tracks off, for example, so that those vehicles could no longer take part in that particular assault, but could maybe be repaired later. And then the press officer for Ukraine's 26th Artillery Brigade, Oleh Kalishnikov, stated that Russian forces around Bakhmut are not conducting battalion-sized ground attacks because Ukrainian drones, well, they are so visible. Everything, all movement is so visible. Drones just attack them. And instead, he says, Russian forces are using groupings up to company-sized groups. So, like I say, about 100-ish, but certainly no more than that. Kalashnikov further stated Russian forces in Bakhmut are suffering from low morale. Like I say, a facet we're hearing more and more up and down the line. And also using barrier troops to prevent Russian soldiers from retreating. Now, barrier troops, this is a particularly loathsome element of the Russian military psychology. These are troops that form a line behind the assaulting forces and shoot them if they come back. So if they run away, the assaulting forces are repelled or run away from Ukrainian positions. They're then met with a line of guns from their own side to shoot them, basically. And we have seen evidence of that. Russian forces, as we know, previously used mass infantry-led frontal assaults to take Bakhmut and at the beginning of their efforts to seize Avdiivka, although they had to break it down after the initial few weeks. But they have now moved to using much smaller forces. We think, this is also coming from Russian sources, we think that they are suffering from exhaustion and the lack of rotations, as in just not taking people out of the line. But they are continuing to fight on new lines west of Avdiivka. ISW say they previously, and in their own words, they say not always accurately. Information is very difficult to come by. ISW accept their limitations there. They say they previously and not always accurately assessed how low Russian morale has been and exhaustion, how much it's affected the prospects of Russian offensive operations, but reiterate that Ukraine's current material shortages make it difficult for Ukrainian forces to either take advantage of that or defend against just these continuous waves of human assault, albeit in smaller groupings. ISW continues to assess that Russia's opportunities to exploit Ukrainian vulnerabilities will widen as these limits in military aid persist. And just one more, Dave, whilst I'm here. The Danish Defence Ministry announced a new 2.2 billion kroner, that's about $313 million, package of military aid yesterday. This one is Denmark's 17th delivery of military aid since the beginning of the full-scale invasion. The last one was in March, a similar size, slightly larger, but very similar size. Plus, at that time, another $6 million equivalent was gifted by the Danish Foreign Ministry for Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Now, the funds from the latest aid package will be spent on the development specifically of Ukraine's maritime capabilities, a little bit on drones and the production of missile parts as well, in cooperation with the Netherlands and Czech Republic. Part of it, so 200 million kroner, we're told, about $30 million, will go directly in investing in Ukraine's defence industry. It's for them to decide what weapons and ammunition to purchase. Danish Defence Minister Troels Lund Poulsen said yesterday, in March, I visited a number of Ukrainian defence companies in Kyiv and became clear that there was a great potential for future cooperation that can supply the necessary equipment to Ukraine, which will help change the situation on the battlefield. More and more of the sort of Western defence industrial base are taking a stake in Ukraine, physically in Ukraine. BAE Systems opened an office. You know, very small, but a start, and it's this effort to try to ramp up the production capacity inside the country, as well as what should be happening outside. But that is a much bigger issue. Now, according to the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, which tracks international aid for Ukraine, Denmark is the fourth largest provider of military aid to Kyiv, committing so far about 8.4 million euros worth, about $9 million US dollars, as at January the 15th. This is from the start of the full-scale invasion. I mean, in real terms, not as much as some others, but in terms of GDP, at 2.4%, that makes Denmark the second largest provider of military aid in terms of GDP as a percentage overall, after Estonia at 3.6%, closely followed by Lithuania, Norway and Latvia. They're all over at 1%. Britain, for interest, is at 0.5% of GDP given in military aid to Ukraine at the moment, puts it into puts it into comparison. What's the phrase I'm looking for? Puts it into perspective. Perspective, thank you. And just to finish off, in pure military aid, so discounting financial and other humanitarian aid, which can be very large, but in just pure military aid since the start of the full-scale invasion, the US has supplied 42 billion euros worth. Germany, second, 18 billion. The UK, third, at 9. And Denmark, fourth, with 8 billion euros worth of military aid donated. So, you know, you read into that what you will. But I think that's pretty good showing from Denmark.
Thank you very much, Dom. That was very impressive. 20 minutes of updates. Thank you so much, Dom Nichols. Francis Sternley, what have you been looking at?
Well, thanks, David. No fresh news yet on the timing of the Ukraine military aid package vote in the US Congress following the big news that Speaker Mike Johnson is going to permit that vote this week. There are rumours swirling that it will be put to a vote sooner rather than later, but they are only that, rumours at this stage. So, elsewhere in the political realm, another ongoing debate is coming to a head instead, with leaders of the G7 countries close to agreeing a plan to use frozen Russian assets to fund Ukraine's war effort. An emerging consensus is understood to exist between Western countries on how to take advantage of that more than £220 billion worth in Russian assets that have been frozen since Putin ordered the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. This plan to use Russian assets frozen in the West would be likely to involve interest payments being removed and then sent directly to Kyiv, or the creation of a bond tied to the future revenue from Russian capital. Washington has been pushing a plan to borrow billions to send to Ukraine in loans secured against the future interest on that Russian money, most of which is in Brussels. The ACT idea is supported by the UK, but has encountered opposition from some European states, including Germany, as we've talked about in the past, which has been cautious about the future of such a loan if it had a 10-year maturity date. Such a deal would be likely to have to be agreed between members of the G7 and the EU, where some other countries, including, of course, Hungary and Slovakia, have expressed concerns about repurposing Russian money to fund the war. For some countries, this is all a no-brainer. For others, it raises troubling questions about what precedent it sets for Western assets in foreign countries if these were seized, and what it might mean for future investment if international business people think that their assets might not be secure in traditionally safe Western countries after all. But as Bill Browder, the well-known financier and political activist who we've interviewed on the podcast in the past, has argued vocally today, whilst that might be a concern if only certain countries were to seize assets, it would surely not be the case if every Western country agreed to do so. Although I should add that he himself doesn't believe that the interest payments on assets goes far enough and that the assets themselves should be seized, i.e. the £220 billion worth. Now, I know a few people have glazed over in that segment. This is a complicated subject which can feel obtuse compared to what is happening on the battlefield. But it really does matter. As the 15th century Marshal Gian Giacomo Trivulzio famously wrote, to carry out war, three things are necessary: money, money, and yet more money. We forget that at our peril. Another update, too, on the protests in Georgia over that controversial foreign agents bill, which its opponents call the Russian law. The Georgian parliament postponed that vote on the first reading of the bill last night amid heavy protests, although there is still a chance it will be put forward later today. For context, the bill, first introduced in 2023 by the ruling Georgian Dream Party, would require organisations that receive foreign funding to be labelled as such. Widespread demonstrations broke out in protest of that proposed law, and it was eventually abandoned in March last year. The reason there's such criticism of this is it has a resemblance to similar legislation passed in Russia. Moscow's Foreign Agents Registry has been widely used to target and silence groups and individuals who are critical of the government, including independent journalists, activists, and NGOs. The Georgian Dream Party recently reintroduced that legislation in Parliament, renaming it as a bill on the transparency of foreign influence. That decision, too, sparked mass protests in the capital of Tbilisi. Even within the parliamentary session, debate over the bill has remained extremely tense. Indeed, the leader of Georgian Dream's parliament faction and a key force behind the bill was actually punched in the face by an opposition MP while speaking from the dispatch box during an early discussion of the revived bill. Georgian police are reportedly using tear gas to break up the demonstrations outside of the parliament. The real issue here, relevant for our purposes, is its perceived connection to Russia, with some opposition figures arguing that Russia is somehow implicated in all this. Indeed, we know the Kremlin is supportive of the bill passing, as its spokesman Peskov said so explicitly, which we reported on a couple of weeks ago. For the EU as well, the bill is incompatible, their phrase, with European values and would hurt Georgia's chances of entering the bloc if it passed. That would, of course, be another reason why Moscow would be in favour of pushing for it. So an interesting story, more on it as we have it. And just lastly, let's turn again to the questions posed by the events in the Middle East over the weekend. As the Kyiv Independent has dived into, the question of why Western countries cannot defend Ukraine's airspace in the same way they did for Israel is now a hot topic. Josep Borrell, the EU's top diplomat, has acknowledged that this is a well-founded critique, but said that the two situations cannot be compared, that it is not possible to provide Ukraine with its own version of Israel's Iron Dome. He said, and I quote, "It has taken years and years to build and has a very high cost. Even if we had the money in the box, it wouldn't be built in one night." He also said that some of Iran's missiles and drones flew over air bases of the armies of France, the US, the UK and Jordan, prompting those countries to act in self-defense. There are no air bases of the UK or the US, much less Jordan, of course, on Ukrainian territory or in a territory within which Russian missiles fly over. Therefore, the same answer cannot be given because the circumstances are not the same. But having said that, of course, the delivery of air defence to Ukraine must be accelerated and strengthened. Interestingly, US State Department spokesman Matthew Miller echoed this sentiment at a press conference, telling the press that Ukraine is just in a different position. "We are not in armed military conflict with Russia, which is what it would require for US planes to be in the skies over Ukraine engaging with Russian attacks. And we are not going to be in direct armed conflict with Russia." I have to say, I do find it rather curious that the idea of shooting down missiles, not planes, inbound for civilian targets, a war crime in Ukraine, is considered direct armed conflict with Russia. But that does seem to be the collective position for those listeners who've asked for more details on what the Western position is on this. I know it's riled many of you, as of course it has us. Now, just lastly on this, since we mention Iran, it is worth stressing here that Putin has showed support for Iranian aggression against Israel in a call with the Iran president back in March. As the ISW has described, Putin expressed hope that Israel and Iran would show reasonable restraint and not allow a new round of confrontation, effectively preemptively blaming Israel for any response to the massive but unsuccessful Iranian missile and drone strike over the weekend. In my view, which is why I mention this, not enough attention is paid to Putin's interventions in the Middle East. Lest we forget, he invited Hamas representatives to the Kremlin after October 7th, as well as providing political cover and financial support to the Ayatollahs. As we've discussed in the past, there are numerous advantages for him to stoke unrest in the region, distracting the world from Ukraine, driving a wedge between the West and the so-called rest, and also giving him an opportunity to return to the top table of international diplomacy. Russia is implicated in a lot of this, but for some reason there doesn't seem to be as extensive a discussion at the top level with European leaders and Western leaders more broadly as one might expect, David.
Well, thank you so much, Francis Sternley and Dominic Halls, for your reporting and time there. Svitlana, it's wonderful to have you back with us in the studio. Welcome back to The Telegraph. Let's talk about mobilisation. You've been writing a lot on this, doing a lot of research. Set the scene for us. Why is the bill recently passed in the Ukrainian parliament important?
Thank you, David. Ukrainian frontline lacks not only ammunition, air defences, but also soldiers. The issue arose last summer following unsuccessful Ukrainian counteroffensive, and with each passing month after that, the issue grew more acute with an increasing toll of casualties. Soldiers were killed, injured, or they're simply exhausted from 2 years of combat. There are no reserves to replace them. And the average age of the Ukrainian soldier in the army is over 40 years old. So when this issue became so acute, Ukrainian government, they developed a draft law, and it took them over 1 year to come up with ideas to review more than 4,000 amendments and vote for it. And only this week, Volodymyr Zelensky has signed it. Once it is enforced in the middle of May, more men aged 25 and over will undergo military training for 2 to 3 months and then head to the front line in time for Russian summer offensive. We don't know how many men will be called up in Ukraine, but Moscow plans to conscript up to 300,000 people. About the mobilization law, it introduces mandatory medical commission checks for those men who previously held the partially eligible status due to health or other issues. These men will be categorized as either ineligible or eligible. And the government is also now allowed to track Ukrainian men of military age who are living abroad, but won't have the right to ask for their deportation to Ukraine yet. The law also introduces an electronic register for all conscripts in Ukraine and gives the right to disabled soldiers and those who have returned from Russian captivity to discharge themselves. Other provisions include penalties for those deemed to be dodging the draft, including the potential revoking of consular services and even driver licenses.
Thank you so much for that, Svitlana. What is not in the bill, though? You've taken us through some of the provisions. What has been left out, do you think?
There is one big thing that was left out by the request of Oleksandr Sirsky, the new commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian army. Lawmakers have removed provisions on the mobilization and the rotation of military personnel from the bill. Sirsky said it was taking too long to approve it, while Ukraine needed more men immediately. So the government now has 8 months to come up with another draft law, which would guarantee that military service is not everlasting. Well, that was a big disappointment for Ukrainian soldiers and their families. Sirsky's intervention means that soldiers who thought that they could go back to a peaceful life after 3 years of service have to wait to leave the army again. Some Ukrainian fighters have not left the battlefield since 2014, when Russia started a war in Donbas. Tens of thousands have been fighting for more than 2 years. They are exhausted, their morale is low, they don't have enough weapons to fight. So Parliament tried to motivate them somehow and voted to pay soldiers on the front line an additional £1,400 a month for staying 30 days on the front line. It's a nice bonus, of course, but it's nowhere near the dismissal from service that fighters have been asking for. So Kyiv has to find a way to send these men home without hurting Ukraine's defense capabilities. And it seems that it's not going to happen in the nearest future. Also, there has been a big scandal about booking from conscription. In Ukraine, different companies can reserve men to keep them on the important job, so they can reserve them and they won't be called up. But issues arise when people try to determine what jobs are important in supporting critical infrastructure, and there are certain loopholes in the legal system that open up space for abuse. And last week, Ukraine's culture ministry has recognized a number of TV channels, circuses, theaters, operas, and other cultural institutions as critically important companies during wartime, allowing some of their employees to defer military service. And this decision led to a uproar on Ukrainian social media, with people asking if circuses are really that important when the country is fighting for its survival. It's also important to mention that one of those critically important companies was the Telemarathon United News. I don't know if you heard about it before. It's when, like, Russia invaded 2 years ago. Some Ukrainian TV channels, they emerged into one. And first, of course, they kept people informed on the latest developments of the war. But with the time, they became like a platform for governmental propaganda or promoting the government. And they have been inviting only people from Zelensky party to give commentary on the war. So Ukrainians have been recently asking them to stop that project, because millions of Ukrainian hryvnias are spent on that project, and people say that better to send those money to the army and buy more drones or whatsoever is needed.
And Svetlana, could you, you've touched on it, but do you have more on the kind of reaction that this bill passing has had in Ukraine? How are people especially younger people, who of course with the fact that the age of conscription is going down as well to 25 from 27. What's been the reaction amongst younger people that you know of, that you can tell us, to all of this stuff going through?
Yes, of course. Look, I am 25, and many of my friends are 25 years old too. And of course, they are not happy. The conscription bill is not popular. And I think the main issue is that why there are not volunteers right now who want to go voluntarily to the army. The first main issue is that there is no specific terms of service for the soldiers. It's like one-way ticket to go to the army. You don't know. The only chance you will come back, it is or in a plastic bag or seriously injured. Second, it is that they are afraid that they won't have weapons to fight. And, you know, when Ukrainians see that the U.S. is stalling with their aid bill and other countries, we don't have weapons. And, of course, they don't want to go to the army. And I guess people see right now that Ukraine is losing, and it also demotivates them a lot. Because, for example, before the Ukrainian counteroffensive, a lot of people actually believed that Ukraine could win very soon, and they wanted to join the army to finish the war faster. But now it doesn't seem possible. So I think that is the main reason why Ukrainian government has been for 1 year talking about the conscription bill, and they were trying to avoid voting for it. Zelensky was trying to avoid it in his speeches. But I think why they voted for it now, because our Western allies started asking, okay, you are asking for more weapons, more money, but you can't even pass the conscription bill, so why should we help you?
And Svetlana, you've touched on it, but could you just give us a sense of, you know, what happens now? When does this come into force? When will we start seeing the results of it on the front lines?
Look, the law will start working in the middle of May. And then more soldiers will be conscripted. But from the moment you are conscripted, you have to pass the medical commission and then to receive the training that it will be supposedly for from 2 to 3 months. And then you will be sent to the front line or to the other place of your deployment. So I think we will see the results of this conscription like in the end of summer, the beginning of autumn. I think it is a bit too late, because Russian offensive is supposedly to start in the end of spring, and Ukraine doesn't have enough soldiers at the front line to hold the whole front line, you know, because it's like 600 miles long, and Russians are attacking from several directions. So Ukraine will have to choose which cities to protect and which to leave.
Svetlana, thanks so much for joining us today. Just one question for me. When we were in Ukraine in February, I was chatting to a drone operator who was 20. Now, let me work this one out. I'll come back to the age in a moment. But the point was that he was under the age of current conscription and what the new so 27, and he was under 25, the new age. I think he was 22 from memory, but the point was that he was younger, but he wanted to do his bit. He said he came from a family that was very strongly in support of the military and pushing back against Russia. So he was very happy to do his bit. He had a predilection for drones, so he was, you know, that's why he was doing that. But he said many of the people that he worked with were also, a lot of their motivation came from wanting to have an established role and an established relationship with a particular unit, so that when they came of age to be drafted, they had somewhere to go. And now these guys were forward. They were back in Kyiv, and when I was chatting to him, obviously, but no, he was regularly going forward, and they're taking their chances there. I'm not saying these people are looking for an easy fight, but he did say that some of the motivation from the people around him were because they didn't want to be the PBI, the poor bloody infantry, the you know, less well-trained, just sort of, you know, in the trenches. They wanted to try and carve out a different role for them. Right, you can take a view on whether or not that's a particularly honourable position to take. And as I say, these guys are still taking their chances. They're going forward. They are running the risks. But do you think that many people will try and do similar, try and establish links early with units to they will then be drafted into, partly because they don't want to go into the infantry?
Thank you so much for your question. I would say right now it's very popular practice in Ukraine, and even the defense ministry, they advise men to choose the unit they would like to join, to talk to them. They can receive their written note that they agree that that person will join. It's called like recruiting in Ukraine right now, and defense ministry, they established several offices through all around Ukraine, and a man can come there and receive the consultations about different units and how can they be useful there. And when you come to that consultation, you are not obliged to join. It is you won't be called up immediately, you know. And it became really popular because people, the most are afraid to end up in the infantry, on the trenches, on the ground zero, and you know that there it's so easy to die. And some hope they have certain skills and they would like to use them. So yes, it's very popular practice, and I think it's a very good use of people's skills, so they can choose and we can have everyone on their place. But the problem is we still need infantry, you know, and nobody wants to go to infantry. So sometimes I guess not all the men know about this opportunity that they can choose the unit, or maybe some units are full and they don't accept more men, and then the defense ministry will determine where they will serve.
Svitlana, thanks so much for coming in today. My question is actually related to this, which is on the subject of popularity of certain, not just units, but actual whole areas of the armed forces. Do you see more young people interested, say, in the Air Force, in the Navy, versus, or as Don was saying, drone warfare? Or is that sort of a rather outdated way of thinking about things? I'm just interested in the way that different ages want to approach signing up.
I would say that to be a drone operator is the most popular position right now. I guess partly because it allows you don't need to be in the first line to launch a drone. You can be behind. Yes. So it is safer. And right now, there are a lot of schools in Ukraine, drone schools, private and governmental, that teach how to operate a drone. So it's very easy, and they have like from 2 to 3 weeks of training and they are ready to go. And I guess a lot of young people choose that, but I also heard then older do it too. I think mainly because it is safer, and secondly, I guess it's nice to fly a drone.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's just so extraordinary to me. If we think back to the beginning of this war, if we would have said, you know, that 2 years in, the most popular thing people want to do is fly drones, people would have said, gosh, that marks a transformation in warfare. And it, in a sense, it does, because it's a new area that's really captured people's, not just imaginations, but they've also proven their utility on the battlefield.
Yes, and at the beginning, we didn't know that drones would be so useful role in the war as they are right now. And actually, Ukraine needs thousands of drone operators to have them in every unit, you know, because right now, as Ukraine can't advance, Russia is advancing, but slowly. Mostly it is just a fight between drones.
Coming up, Francis, Dom and Svetlana share their final thoughts.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's go to our final thoughts. Francis or Dom, would you like to go first?
Yeah, thanks, David. A couple of quickies for me. One, apropos, not an awful lot, but I noticed today there's breaking news that Russia has announced it's going to make a total withdrawal of its troops from Nagorno-Karabakh, which is down in the Caucasus. There's obviously been a lot of changes there politically and militarily in the last few weeks, but the reports I've seen largely say this is because they need the men and materiel in Ukraine. That's breaking as we came on air today, so we'll have more on that tomorrow. We need to get James Kilner, I think, back to put it into context. But the other thing I'd mention is in this context, as Francis was saying earlier on about the strikes against or the Iranian attack on Israel over the weekend and the efforts by Britain, France, Germany, Jordan, Saudi Arabia and others to help Israel and defend Israel. And what's the difference between that and Ukraine? Well, I'd hinted strongly. So yesterday I interviewed one of the British defence ministers, so the Minister for Defence Procurement, James Cartledge, MP, been MinDP, Minister for Defence Procurement, as I say, since April last year. We were speaking about procurement in the round, but, you know, being a journalist, you've always got to get the sting in the tail. I then asked him, I said, why did the MOD feel that it could order the RAF to shoot down Iranian drones flying towards Israel, but it won't order the RAF to shoot down Iranian drones flying towards Ukraine? And he stuck to the position. I'm afraid there's no great headline here, I'm afraid, folks. But, you know, he stuck to the government's position, as evidenced by Lord Cameron recently, the Foreign Secretary, saying it's not British policy to be, I'd have to look at the exact quote, but it was something like decisively engaged or directly involved with Russian forces. And you know, I pushed the point. I said they might not have to be. They don't have to be. They weren't directly involved last Saturday night with Iranian troops on the ground in Iran or elsewhere. You know, you're shooting down lumps of metal and microchips and plastic and all the other gubbins. You know, this, yes, would be, as I said the other day, would be held by some in Russia to be hugely provocative and escalatory and, you know, casus belli and all the rest of it. But I personally choose to think that would not be. It would be a manageable step up the ladder of escalation, I think. But there's no right or wrong. There's no way to prove it. It is a government position, and for now, the decision by the British government is that they would not engage Russian missiles, drones, bombs in the air, let alone, you know, regardless of whether or not it causes harm to Russian troops on the ground. So that was from a defence minister on the record last night. So it doesn't seem that the British position is going to change anytime soon, David.
Thank you very much, Dom Nichols. Francis Sternley.
Well, thanks, David. Just because it's caught the imagination of so many listeners, many of whom wrote in, the result of the poll of who wore it better. For context, if you're wondering what on earth is he banging on about, I walked into the studio last week only to see Dom and David wearing the exact same outfit, a blue shirt, yellow trousers and brown shoes. It was rather eerie, to be honest with you. The results are in, as I say, of the poll that was conducted on Twitter. Team Onions on 68.3%. and Team Scraggly Beard on 31.7%. So it is a win for Team Onions and Dom Nichols. I have to say, David, there are quite a few critiques of the lack of polish on your shoes. Do you want to respond to your critics?
I have nothing to add, Francis. I don't accept the results of this poll. It's undemocratic, and you know I'm not going to be internationally recognising it, I'm afraid.
The irony is, listeners, that David has a spectacular wardrobe of tweed jackets, which he often wears and which put everyone else to shame in the office, which is why this is quite so much fun.
Well, thank you very much, Dom and Francis. Svetlana, can we hear your final thoughts? As our guest, you have the final words.
Thank you, David. I have to say that no amount of conscripted soldiers will help to stop Russian forces if they won't have the tools to do that. But the most urgent critical need right now is for air defenses, and it is not only to protect Ukrainian cities in the rear, but also for soldiers on the front line, because the lack of air defenses has exposed Ukrainian troops to Russia, and Russian aircraft have been dropping thousands of bombs on them for the first time in the war. And Zelensky last week said that Ukraine needs 25 Patriot air defense systems to close the sky over Ukraine completely. But taking into account that our allies are not so keen to supply that amount, Ukraine is begging for at least 6. But we don't know how long it will take. And I just would say that I would ask the listeners to urge their government to supply Ukraine air defenses.
Well, thank you very much, Dom and Francis. A huge thanks to Svetlana. It's great to have you in the studio, and I'm sure all of our listeners will wish you all the best in tomorrow's Press Awards, where you're nominated for Best Young Journalist in the UK. So best of luck with that, Svetlana.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.